Good evening. This is a COS meeting on May 4th, 2017, 2100 Eastern Time. Welcome. And I see that we have Captain John and Nikki both. And I'm looking forward to hearing what we have on the store tonight. So, go ahead. Take it away.
Well, good evening, everybody. I charge Robert Bristow extra for this presentation, but everybody else, you're free. Okay, so here we go. Tonight's presentation, as mentioned prior, is going to be on the historical context of committees of safety. And for those of you that would like to follow along with the passages I'm about to read, you can find the document on any of our NLA Tri-State Facebook pages, or you can go to the National Liberty Alliance website and click on Committees of Safety and scroll down to the comments section, and you will find it there. So you can follow along with me as I read it. So now you know where to find all that stuff. And why is my laptop not coming up? I'm trying to get to the... Oh, there it is. Okay. So I'm going to read the exact passage that I had described last week first as an opener, because I'm going to go chronologically. So I took this directly from Sovereign Duty by Chris Ann Hall, about a speech given by James Otis Jr. in 1761. And it starts, 40 years later, John Adams would write about the day in court with James Otis Jr. with a promptitude of classical allusions, a depth of research, a rapid summary of historical events and dates, a profusion of legal authorities, a prophetic glare of his eyes into the future, and a rapid torrent of impetuous eloquence, he hurried away all before him. American independence was then and there born. The seeds of patriots and heroes to defend the vigorous youth were then and there sown. Every man of an immense crowded audience appeared to me to go away, as I did, ready to take up arms against writs of assistance. And my note is, those are King's executive orders. Then and there was the first scene of the first act of opposition to the arbitrary claims of Great Britain. Then and there, the child of independence was born. In 15 years, namely in 1776, he grew up to manhood and declared himself free. And that is directly from John Adams, March 29, 1817, in a personal letter to William Tudor out of the works of John Adams, second president of the United States, Little Brown and Company, 1856. Adams then and there asserted, I will to my dying day oppose, with all my powers and faculties God has given me, all the instruments of slavery on the one hand and villainy on the other, as this writ of assistance is. With the clarity that history provides, we can see that James Otis Jr. was not alone in the courtroom that day. He was being watched by Samuel Adams, John Adams, Richard Henry Lee, and many of the men who would become liberty for the new nation. From that courtroom, Samuel Adams left so supercharged that he formed the Committees of Correspondence, groups that would be established throughout the colonies to educate beyond the government-controlled media, unite liberty-minded patriots, and fight for liberty. The first publication was a booklet called The Boston Pamphlet, a series of reports outlining colonists' rights and Parliament's infringements upon those rights. Because of the education provided to the colonists through these committees of correspondence, Samuel Adams also formed the first political action committee called the Sons of Liberty. The most famous action of the Sons of Liberties was the Boston Tea Party. That's the end of the quote, and that is where the committees came from. So that takes care of the historic background. So now we're going to move into April 12th of 1775, and this is right off of Robert's site. In Province of Congress, Concord, April 12th, 1775, hereas, the preservation of our country from slavery, depends under God on an effectual execution of the continental and provincial measures for that purpose. Resolve that there, and now you're going to see where this comes from, that there be now appointed for each county in this country a committee consisting of 5 persons, any 3 of whom to be a quorum, whose business it shall be to receive from the committees of correspondence in their respective counties a state of the conduct of the towns and districts with respect to their having executed the continental and provincial plans as aforesaid. And it shall be the duty of said committees to meet on the first Wednesdays of May, July, September, November, January, and March, and prepare a report of the same to be laid before the Congress at its then next session, that any neglect of such towns and districts in executing such plans may be speedily and effectually remedied. Also resolved that it be, and it is hereby strongly recommended, to the committees of correspondence in the several towns and districts in this colony, sometime before the first Wednesday in May, July, September, November, January, and March aforesaid, to render to any one of the members of their county committees aforesaid a true state of the conduct of their respective towns and districts with respect to their having executed each plan recommended by the Continental and Provincial Congresses, and to use their utmost diligence for this important purpose. And where some towns and districts in the colony may be destitute of so excellent an institution as committees of correspondence, resolved that it be, and it is hereby strongly recommended to such towns and districts forthwith to choose them, and to afford them assistance at all times in effectually suppressing the efforts of the enemies of America whenever they shall make them. Signed by order of the Provincial Congress, John Hancock, President. And now we get into the committees of safety. And I am going to do 3 colonies. I'm going to do Massachusetts, Virginia, and North Carolina for very important reasons. So this is Massachusetts. When the American colonists laid by the petition for the musket, prepared to put their strength to the test in defense of their rights, the machinery of the English colonial government was hampered and at length rendered helpless by the withdrawal of popular support. That government rested on the supremacy of England over her dependencies, enforced by governors and other royal officials, which Mickey was talking about earlier, hint, hint, but workable only with the cooperation of the colonists in their assemblies. When discontent rose to rebellion, the government, comprising 2 irreconcilable elements in the governors and assemblies, came of necessity to a standstill. The executive attempted to silence the insurrection by dissolving the assemblies, but the people found other channels of expression. Representatives to provincial conventions were elected and gradually resumed entire control. These conventions served the purpose of deliberative and legislative bodies, as well as the former assemblies, but it was difficult for them to perform executive duties on account of their size. Moreover, it was impossible to keep such bodies, large bodies, continually in session and in the frequent recesses and the intervals between a dissolution and the meeting of a new Congress. There was need of some system by which the government could be carried on without interruption. It was to meet these wants that the conventions appointed committees of safety during the earlier years of the Revolution. They served as the chief executive of the province in the transition period from colonial to state government. Opposition culminated early in Massachusetts, and that province was the first to choose a committee of safety. The spirit of resistance ran high in Boston in the fall of 1774. The white tents of the British on the common, the cannon that Gage had planted to command the town, the fleet riding in the harbor, brought no thought of submission to the people. Rather, they were used as effective illustrations by the leaders to point the wrongs of the colonists and of tyranny of England. A martial spirit had sprung up. The people brought together arms and ammunition and drilled in small companies. The situation was discussed in club, convention, and committee. An acceptance of armed resistance, if necessary, was the common outcome of their deliberations. Alarmed at the firmness displayed by the people and their preparations for defense, Gage felt it unsafe to allow the general court to meet and issued a proclamation discharging the members from attendance. But the colonists refused to be denied expression at this critical moment. 90 of the delegates assembled at the time appointed for the assembly, October 5th, 1774, and finding the governor unwilling to recognize them, formed themselves into a provincial congress. A committee was chosen October 20 to consider what was necessary for the safety and defense of the province, and their report was given and accepted on the 26th. The committee reviewed the grievances of the colonies, and while it denied somewhat too strenuously that the people had the most distant idea of attacking or molesting the king's troops in any way, it was held that the necessity of providing against possible contingencies dictated the following measures. First, the appointment of a committee of safety to continue in office until further order, whose duty it was to keep careful watch of any person attempting the destruction, invasion, detriment, or annoyance of the province. The committee, or any five of its number, providing that more than one was a citizen of Boston, were authorized, whenever they judged the safety of the people required, to call out the militia to such places as they saw fit, to see that the men were well armed, equipped, and provisioned, and to keep them in service as long as necessary. All officers and soldiers were earnestly requested to give obedience to the commands of the committee. Second, the appointment of a committee of supplies to make provisions for the reception and support of the troops if called out, and to purchase without delay for the colony cannon, small arms, and ammunition. Third, the appointment of general officers to command the forces. The militia were recommended to choose company officers and to enlist minutemen ready to march at the first call of the Committee of Safety. The inhabitants were urged to perfect themselves in military discipline and to provide arms and powder. These proposals spoke plainly of war. The Congress foresaw its probability and was determined to meet it well prepared. It was left with the Committee of Safety to take the decisive step of calling the troops into the field and of turning the struggle from passive resistance to civil war. Like a sentinel, it was to watch the approach of the enemy and give the signal for attack. The committee was chosen on October 27, 1774, and was composed of 9 members, 3 from Boston and 6 from the country districts. It existed until February 9, 1775, when a new committee of safety was chosen of 11 members, most of them, however, identical with those of the first appointment. As time passed and the situation became more critical, the provincial Congress realized the danger of leaving entirely to the committee of safety the decision of the grounds and time for resistance. In the second appointment, therefore, the committee was authorized to call out the militia only if an attempt were made to execute by force the 2 laws, for the better government of Massachusetts and for the impartial administration of justice. Even as thus limited, the discretionary power of the committee was large. What constituted a forcible attempt to carry out the laws might be open to dispute, and the committee might give the signal on 2 slight occasions. The support of the other colonies was not assured. While weighed with England in numbers, resources, and military skill, Massachusetts hung but lightly in the balance. The thought that the committee, in its confidence and enthusiasm, might force the conflict prematurely made the more thoughtful afraid of its power. Joseph Hawley, a member of the Provincial Congress, wrote from Northampton on February 22, 1775, "I have been most seriously contemplating the commission and most important trust of our Committee of Safety, and especially that branch of it, which relates to their mustering the Minutemen and others of the militia. The soldiers, when then mustered, will suppose it is their duty to fight. They will suppose the continent to have devolved the resolution of that question upon this province, and that this province had devolved it on the Committee of Safety, and that the committee was calling them, had decided it. Thus hostilities will be commenced. I beg of you, therefore, as you love your country, to use your utmost influence with our Committee of Safety, that the people be not mustered and hostilities be not commenced until we have the express categorical decision of the continent that the time has absolutely come that hostilities ought to commence. Events, however, demanded positive actions of Massachusetts too soon to obtain such united assent. The Committee of Safety came together for the first time November 7, 1774. There seems to have been no doubt in the minds of the members from the first that the outcome of events was to be war. The first day, the Committee of Supplies was recommended to buy large amounts of pork, flour, rice, and other provisions and store them at Worcester and Concord. In the following weeks, spades, shovels, mess bowls, fuses, cannon, and ball were collected and deposited at the two places. On February 23, 1775, the committee ordered the officers to assemble one-fourth of the militia, not for a general muster, but in order that the troops might meet for drill throughout the province. Afraid that Gage would attempt to capture the war stores that had been collected, the committee appointed watchers on March 14th and 15th to guard them. Teams were kept in readiness to remove them, and couriers provided to allow the towns on the first news of a hostile movement of the British. On the 18th of April, the Committee of Safety was in session at a tavern in Menotomee, now Arlington. After the sitting, two of the members, Mr. Devins and Mr. Watson, left the others to go to Charlestown, but meeting an unusual number of British officers on the road, turned back to alarm their comrades. Later in the evening, Devins received certain information that the enemy were in motion and went at once to warn Jerry, Hancock, and Adams. He then started Paul Revere on his ride to Lexington and Concord. Through his efforts and those of the other couriers employed by the committee, Gage's secret was the property of the countryside before morning. So I'll stop for a moment and mention Paul Revere's ride was called by a committee of safety. The Battle of Lexington marks the opening of the war, and the Committee of Safety bent its energies to raise forces and concentrate them around Boston as rapidly as possible. The Provincial Congress was not in session, and responsibility in a crisis rested with the committee. On the day after the battle, a circular letter was sent to the different Massachusetts towns telling the news and setting forth in the strongest terms the need of an army and begging them to encourage the enlistment of soldiers and to send them forward to Cambridge. They determined to raise 8,000 capable men from the Massachusetts forces, to organize them into regiments, and place them under proper discipline. In this way, it was hoped the nucleus of an efficient army would be formed. Troops were asked from Connecticut and Rhode Island, and the New Hampshire men in the province were enlisted in the Massachusetts regiments. The Provincial Congress met on the 22nd of April and took general control of affairs, sending for the Committee of Safety to report on the situation and to present whatever plans it had in readiness. Throughout the session, the committee made frequent suggestions to the legislature, and its advice was usually adopted. Occasionally, the Congress referred matters to the committee for consideration, asking it, for example, to form a plan for the establishment of the army, to decide on the expediency of removing war stories from the coast, and to report on the advisability of a further issue of paper money. As the Congress sat usually at Watertown and the committee at Cambridge, where the troops were collecting, much trouble and loss of time was involved carrying messages between the two places, and the committee was often too busy to attend to the questions of the Congress until the second or even third request. That, in spite of difficulties, the Congress took pains to consult. It is evidence of the reliance placed on the judgment and its positions of leadership. In the weeks following the Battle of Lexington, an army was gathered. The committee issued enlistment orders, assigned to the towns the quota of men they were to raise, and ordered them to be ready to move at a moment's notice or to march at once to Cambridge. The committee saw that cannon and trenching tools were collected and repaired. All was made ready for tile siege of Boston. The selectmen and committee of correspondence of Chelsea were directed to prevent any food from reaching the city, and the committee of safety granted or denied permission to enter it. Tile committee did not give attention to Massachusetts alone. Benedict Arnold laid before it a plan for taking Ticonderoga, and it furnished him with powder, balls, flint, and horses. The expedition was sent under its authority, and Arnold was directed to draw on it for expenses. On May 19, 1775, the committee received fresh powers, as it was felt the change in times rendered its former authority inadequate. Its new commission authorized it to call out the militia whenever and for as long as it saw fit, and to station them where it thought best. All officers were required to give the committee obedience. Any command of the Committee of Safety was, however, subject to the control of the Provincial Congress. The committee was to recommend for commissions to the Congress those officers whose regiments were fully or nearly completed, but in the recess of Congress, the committee might give the commissions itself. The Committee of Safety was thus made commander-in-chief of the provincial troops, subject, however, to the control of the legislature. In consequence of this limitation, the natural fruit of long colonial distrust of executive authority, the committee was careful to consult with the Congress before taking steps of importance, unless its freedom of initiative was unfortunately checked to a considerable degree. The committee showed itself ready to consult with the officers, whose knowledge might be more direct than its own, and to accept their advice. For instance, the Council of War, having decided that 2,000 men were necessary to reinforce the army at Roxbury, the Committee of Safety at once issued orders to the militia officers of the neighboring towns to march to that place. Again, representatives of the committee deliberated with the Council of War and some of the general officers on the question of securing Bunker Hill and Dorchester Neck, but though willing to consult with the army, the committee was as punctilious as a long parliament in upholding the ultimate superiority of the civil over the military power. For example, the Provincial Congress directed the Committee of Safety to deliver the small arms to those officers who should present orders for them from General Ward. Thereupon, General Ward issued an order to the committee to deliver the arms to those officers that made applications for them. The committee at once objected. Ward might order his officers to come for the arms. He had no right to order the committee to deliver them. That power rested only with the Provincial Congress. It was a matter of vast importance, the committee held, that no order should be issued by the military to the civil power. Nevertheless, at this moment, public peril was felt to outweigh constitutional principle, and the committee, in good Anglo-Saxon manner, having by protest prevented the establishment of a dangerous precedent, consented to give out the arms. After the first months, the Committee of Safety and the Committee of Supplies acted as separate and independent bodies, an uneconomical arrangement, since the Committee of Safety, as commander of the troops, was in the best position to know what quantities of food, clothing, and other supplies were needed, and where they could be used to the best advantage. Instead, the Committee of Supplies acted on its own initiative, and the Committee of Safety could do no more than occasionally recommend measures to its notice. In the other colonies, the Committee of Supplies was generally subject to the Committee of Safety, or the latter was given its duties as part of its own commission. The trial of suspected Tories lay properly outside the powers of the committee, and it disliked to deal with them for this reason, referring the cases, if possible, to the Provincial Congress and recommending the appointment of a special court of inquiry. The committee was exceedingly careful not to go beyond its commission for any reason and constantly refused to touch matters not expressly delegated to it, except in cases of necessity, while constantly recommending measures to the Congress that seemed advisable. The commission of the committee gave it no general discretionary power to act for the public good. In one respect, however, it was more free than the committees in some of the other colonies. Unless directed to do so in acting on some special resolution of the Congress, it was not obliged to submit its proceedings to that body. July 13, 1775, the last Committee of Safety of Massachusetts was appointed. The colony had decided to go back as nearly as possible to its charter government, to call an assembly, and to elect from this body a number of councillors. The Provincial Congress provided for the election of the new legislature, chose a new Committee of Safety to act in the interval before the assembly met and disbanded. The committee's former commission was abrogated and a new committee given full power until the 13th of July, or until the assembly took away its authority to assemble or discharge the militia on application of the Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Army, or at its own discretion. The power of directing the forces was no longer given to it, but to the Continental Commander. The committee was to procure and employ all such armorers and artificers as were needed by the troops, and to execute all duties given the former committee by particular resolves of the Congress. It was to provide for the poor of Boston and Charlestown, and if possible, to prevent infection from smallpox being communicated by persons from the former town. The trial and disposal of prisoners of war and Tories was at this time definitely assigned to the committee. It was also directed to care for any interests not otherwise provided for, thus being given a freer hand than formerly to provide for the general welfare. If necessary, it might resemble the provincial Congress before the Assembly met. The journal of this Committee of Safety has been lost. Its life was brief, as the new House of Representatives met July 19, 1775. Then, without being formally dissolved, the committee ceased to act, its place being taken partly by the councilors, partly by different committees appointed by the legislature. So that tells us what happened in Massachusetts. That was the first Committee of Safety, and the fact that the Committee of Safety had all this power, and it called up Paul Revere and told him to get on the road. So now I'm going to shift over to Virginia.
Wait a minute. Can I interject something, please? This is Nikki. Is there any questions about what happened in Massachusetts, how it happened, and any questions, concerns?
I have a lot to get through here, so I'm hoping to hold the questions till later.
Okay.
Or we can take questions, and I will eliminate the rest of my presentation. It's kind of
No, go on with your presentation. No, we didn't discuss that. I was just wondering if anybody had any questions or any other input, you know, especially those from New England states.
There's a lot of material here,
and
I want to get through Massachusetts,
yes,
Virginia, and North Carolina because it's very important in
yes,
the context
it is.
Of
okay.
the committees.
Thank
so
you.
Now we
Sorry
shift over to Virginia, and this is July 1775, so the governor of Virginia, a fugitive, and the members of the assembly met at a provincial convention to raise and embody an armed force to defend the province. The flight of the governor left the colony without an executive head. I love that. I'm going to read that again. The flight of the governor left the colony without an executive head, and the convention therefore appointed on the 16th of August a committee of safety of 11 members to continue until its next session. It was to carry into execution all ordinances and resolutions of the convention, to grant commissions to all provincial military officers, to appoint commissaries, paymasters, and contractors, and to provide for the troops. It was to issue warrants on the treasurer to supply these agents with money and pay them for their services, and to settle such incidental expenses as arose in connection with the military establishment. All public stores, war stores, were to be in its charge. The committee, moreover, was made commander-in-chief of the forces of the province, and every officer to the highest was obliged to swear obedience to it. If sufficient danger threatened the colony before the troops, which the convention had determined upon, could be raised and organized, the committee might call upon the volunteer companies which it had already sprung up through the colony to take the field. The committee was directed to keep a journal and lay the account of its proceedings before the convention for inspection. Its members were exempt from enlistment and could hold no military office. A complete break with the royal government was insisted upon, since no member of the committee might fill any position of profit under the crown. 15 shillings a day, which a later convention reduced to 10, was the compensation allowed the members. By other acts of this convention, an appeal to the Committee of Safety was allowed any officer from the decision of a court-martial, and no sentence of death given in such a court could be executed until the Committee of Safety had given its approval. The convention adjourned till the 1st of December, leaving the Committee of Safety in charge. At the beginning of the next session, the committee was continued, and on December 16th, a new one appointed of the same size to sit until the convention's next session. The same powers that the former body had enjoyed were given it, and others added. Any person found aiding the enemy was liable to be seized and imprisoned, and his estates confiscated by the committee, unless the latter saw fit to pardon him. Three men were appointed to act as a court of admiralty, and in all cases where the ship and cargo were condemned, appeal was allowed to the Committee of Safety. It was moreover directed to commission five members from each of the county committees to have jurisdiction over all persons suspected of enmity to the state. It was to hear appeals from their decisions, and its sentence was to be final. If a slave was taken in arms against the colony or in possession of the enemy through his own choice, he could be sent by the committee to any of the French or Spanish West Indies to be exchanged for war stores. If circumstances rendered his transportation inconvenient, it could employ him in any way for the public service. Those inhabitants who refused to take up arms in the American cause, provided they had committed no act of hostility or enmity, might leave the colony under a license from the Committee of Safety. The last provincial convention, the body that framed the new Constitution of Virginia, came together in May 1776. It revived the Committee of Safety, whose term expired with its meeting, and continued until its own dissolution on July 5th. Although the Assembly under the Constitution was not to convene until fall, the convention elected the governor and Privy Council to take charge of the state till then and usher in a new regime. The need for the Committee of Safety, therefore, was taken away, and it passed out of existence with the convention. The functions of the Virginia Company were, in brief, to commission the officers, to command the troops, to appoint agents to equip and feed them, to pay the military expenses of the state, to imprison its hostile inhabitants, to hear appeals from the Admiralty Court, from the County Courts of Inquiry, and the Courts Martial. Its powers were extended, controlling the military and, to a large extent, the financial resources of the colony. But during its administration, no danger threatened Virginia sufficient to test the stability of its authority or its capacity to deal with a crisis. Its work during the year in which it was the executive of the colony consisted merely in organizing the militia, in providing it with necessaries, and in sending troops to retaliate upon the irritating incursions of Lord Dunmore. The greater part of the inhabitants were Whigs, and the orders of the committee were fulfilled without friction. Virginia was not, like New Jersey or Pennsylvania, the scene of a conquering army, and the problems that the committees had to face were not presented. Neither was it at any time obliged to assume the whole authority of the state. The convention was in session during much of the year and directed the committee in various ways. Even during its adjournments, it was still in existence and could always be brought together if sufficient danger threatened. The Committee of Virginia, therefore, occupied a less responsible position than the Councils of Safety of Pennsylvania, New Jersey, or Vermont. The committee led a busy, if not a stirring, life. The actual work of procuring arms, accoutrements, and provisions was largely in the care of commissaries and contractors chosen by it, but they were under the direction of the committee and responsible to it, and every disbursement that was necessary to satisfy the wants of the troops, even the most minute, passed through its hands. Conservative and radical elements clashed in Virginia as in Pennsylvania. The disagreement was not sufficient to overthrow the existing regime, but centering as it did around prominent personalities, brought with it sufficient bitterness. Patrick Henry, the leader of the Radicals, had been appointed Commander-in-Chief of the Virginia Army by the convention. At the head of the Committee of Safety was Edmund Pendleton, one of the foremost conservatives. It would seem that Henry was, as a matter of fact, a better orator than general. At all events, his military capacity was distrusted to such an extent by the Committee of Safety that Colonel Woodford, a subordinate but more experienced officer, was detailed by it to command the expedition against Lord Dunmore. Opportunity for military achievement was rare in Virginia then, and Henry felt the task should have been his. He resented the fact that Woodford reported directly to the committee and not to him. And finally, when the committee ordered Henry to prepare for winter quarters, It seemed it was purposely refusing him any opportunity of an engagement before the Virginia troops could be taken into the Continental Army, where he would be deprived of chief command. Henry never forgot the treatment accorded him, nor did his friends. When he resigned his commission in March 1776, ready tongues insinuated that the envy of the committee had sought to undermine his reputation and force him to the step. Supporters of the government hastened to clear the committee from blame. The factional contest reappeared later in the contest over the election of the president of the Virginia Convention, and the question was discussed at large in the pages of the Virginia Gazette. Little judicial duty fell to the committee. As has been seen, the first trial of suspects rested with the judges appointed from the county committees and commissioned by the committees of safety, and cases of appeal were only rarely brought before the latter. The greater part of the counties were well affected to the American cause, but Princess Anne and Norfolk contained many Tories, who lent aid to Lord Dunmore and gave intelligence of the plans of the Americans. These districts were sometimes ravaged by parties from the British fleet in search of provisions, and the Committee of Safety, at the suggestion of General Lee, determined upon the extraordinary measure of removing the population of the two counties into the interior to keep the friendly inhabitants from harm and to prevent the Tories from communicating with the fleet. An order to this effect was issued April 10, 1776. All inhabitants, whether friendly or hostile, that resided between the shore and the American posts were directed to remove at once to the interior. To compel them to go, their livestock and slaves were to be seized by the army and redelivered only when they had complied with the order. All those in any part of the two counties who had previously joined the British side or taken oath to support it were to move at least 30 miles away from the shore, and when forced submission, the slaves of all suspected of belonging to this class were to be taken to be returned only at the order of the committee when the owners were settled in some secure place. Three men were appointed to superintend the matter, and £1,000 was to be advanced to them to pay the expenses. All who were willing to provide dwellings for the emigrants were requested to give notice to the Virginia Gazette. It is difficult to justify a proceeding so arbitrary and so productive of needless suffering. Its apologists have claimed that, though harsh, it was rendered necessary by the dangers of the time. This does not seem probable, for Lord Dunmore had not shown himself able to gain any ground in Virginia or to deal the Americans any effective blow. The committees may have feared the approach of Howe's fleet and army, but there was no certainty of their coming. No serious danger threatened, and it seemed an absurdity, in spite of the grave assertions of the committee, to depopulate the counties to protect them from marauding expeditions and to prevent the Tories from furnishing the fleet with supplies. It was reasonably certain that in leaving and losing their houses and land and their businesses, in subjecting their livestock and slaves to the uncertainty they must encounter before they were recovered, and in removing to a strange part of the colony, the inhabitants would suffer more loss, discomfort, and distress than it was possible to receive from the enemy's guns. As for the Tories, it would seem far less trouble to keep so vigilant a guard. The communication with the ships would be impossible than to attempt the task of transporting them all into the interior. Got to go with them on that one. It is a striking illustration of the despotic character of the revolutionary governments and of the folly into which their excessive fear of the British arms and their inexperience in government led them. Steps were soon taken to enforce the order, and Colonel Woodford was directed to take general charge of the removal and to deal with the people as humanely as possible. Woodford complied and set about his task. This high-handed interference with persons and property aroused inevitable opposition, and a petition was sent to the committee from Princess Anne County, setting forth the distress that would ensue if the order was fully executed. It was therefore reconsidered and modified to some extent. Six men were appointed to find out those in the two counties who had taken active part in behalf of the American cause, those who had remained quietly neutral, and those who had appeared in opposition. The commanding officer at Suffolk or vicinity was to allow their friends and neutrals to remain unmolested, but to send into the interior all livestock not necessary for the subsistence. Those who had committed themselves against the cause were still forced to remove from their families and effects. The convention met early in May and the conditions were altered again. Besides, the Tories had friendly inhabitants within certain sections were ordered to leave because of the particular danger of their situation. The rest were free to remain, unless the commander of the neighboring troops, on urgent necessity, saw fit to remove them. The expenses of the American sympathizers were to be paid by the public, those of the disaffected from the sale of their estates. It was found, however, that the people of the two counties were in distress for want of food, and on May 16th, a resolution was passed by the convention permitting the men of the Whig Party to remain and care for their crops, but obliging the removal of their families, slaves, and livestock. There was little probability of this order being carried out. It took from the farmers the important service of their cattle and slaves. It involved the separation of families and placed the support of women and children on the government. It involved the separation of families and placed the support of the women and children on the government. Having conceded so much, it is not surprising to find the convention a fortnight later rescinding the order for removal entirely as far as it related to friends. The Tories were still compelled to leave. In the absence of evidence to the contrary, it is reasonable to assume that the orders against the Whigs may not have been rigidly enforced and that they have may suffered comparatively little. They were few in number, and the frequent issue of directives concerning them show that some at least must have remained in their homes throughout. Between April 10 and May 3rd, the officers probably waited to know the results of the petition. From May 3rd to May 11th, when the first order of the convention was passed, the Whigs were under the protection given to the council. There remained then only the time from the 11th to the 28th when the order was repealed, when they were in any considerable danger, and during that period, influence was probably busy to secure delay, mitigation, and at length, the total repeal of the obnoxious measure. The Tories probably suffered considerably. Lee writes from Suffolk on April 23rd, that he is busy clearing the country of them, and an overseer of the poor in the county of Norfolk speaks of the removal of a great many of the inhabitants with their families and goods. Confiscation of their estates made the departure profitable to the government, and it was therefore not likely to be stopped. The sufferings of the Tories darkened the pages of our revolutionary history. Men dreaded the power of their numbers, their wealth, and their influence, and fear was quick to devise harsh measures. However successful its work along other lines, the Virginia Committee, in ordering the removal of the Tories from Princess Anne and Norfolk counties, must stand condemned both for want of judgment and humanity. So you can see that there's a huge difference between Massachusetts' situation and Virginia's, and we're going to find out shortly that the North Carolina situation was quite different as well. So now we move to North Carolina. Of the two Carolinas, the northern was less favored with the attention and care of the mother country. The affection and gratitude felt by her people toward England was much slighter than that which bound South Carolina, and neglect bred in them a self-reliance and independence that brought confidence of success when they joined the Revolution. Moreover, the governor of North Carolina and the assembly were in conflict just previous to the war, and the leaders of the latter, at the first signals of general opposition, broke away from the government in relief at the prospect of having their own way, unhampered by the representatives of the crown. The ideas and principles of the revolution found quick sympathy in North Carolina, and joined to their local troubles, won the people to the common cause. Provincial congresses were called, and in spite of the denunciation of the governor, the administration passed into their hands. Rendered powerless in his civil capacity, with no military protection, deprived even of the few cannon he had gathered for his defense, and feeling with good reason that his position was insecure, the governor, in the summer of 1775, took refuge in the king's sloop of war, the Crusader, that was anchored in the Cape Fear River. The Congress thereupon shifted the blame for the situation upon his helpless shoulders, I think that's funny, declaring that he had refused to exercise the functions of his office and abandoned his province without occasion, having thus justified themselves with reminiscence, perhaps, of the British and King Parliament and King James II, the Congress created a temporary executive of its own. There already existed in the province, town, and county committees, which had been in active operation since their appointment in the fall of 1774, as committees of inquiry and correspondence. These committees regulated the affairs of their district and treated harshly any who dared raise a voice in opposition. This system of committees was too well-rooted and too useful to be abolished, but their excesses had displeased many of the moderate Whigs, and it was decided to bring them, if possible, under greater control. On September 9, 1775, a graded system of committees was established to serve as the colony's executive, in place of Governor Martin and the royal officials. A provincial council of 13 members was elected by ballot in the Congress, two named by the members from each of the six districts, and one by the Congress as a whole. This council, in the recess of the legislature, was to issue to the officers their certificates of appointment, which were to take the place of commissions. The militia officers that were chosen by the people might be disallowed in the council to prevent the choice of unsuitable persons. Any vacancies among the officers were to be filled at the council's appointment. It was to have the direction, regulation, arid maintenance of the army, and the whole military establishment, subject only to the control of Congress. It might suspend any officer or order a court-martial whose sentence was to be final, unless otherwise decided by the Congress. Finally, it was given discretionary power to do everything it judged necessary for the security and defense of the province, provided that this did not involve the alteration or suspension of any act of the legislature. To render its power effective, it was authorized to draw on the treasury for any sum necessary for the public service. The members were to meet but once in 3 months, unless circumstances compelled more frequent sessions. 10 shillings a day were allowed them for expenses. Any vacancy in the council in the recess of Congress was to be filled by vote of the Committee of Safety of the district in which the vacancy had occurred. The commission of this board bears a close resemblance to that of South Carolina to her safe Council of Safety in the previous June, and it seems probable that it may have been modeled upon it. Below the provincial council came district committees of safety, consisting of a president and 12 other members who were to sit quarterly in the chief towns in their respective districts. They were to be chosen by ballot in the provincial Congress by the representatives of the different districts. Under the control of the provincial council, they were to direct the militia and other forces of the colony. They were to receive information and punish offenders both as a court of original jurisdiction. I want to repeat that. Committees of safety, they were to receive information and punish offenders both as a court of original jurisdiction and also as a court of appeal from the town and county committees. No person holding a military office, except in the militia, could act either as a member of the provincial council or of a committee of safety. Full power was given to both bodies to compel debtors who were suspected of being about to leave the province with debts unpaid, to give security to their creditors, or in default of this, to cause the person or property of the delinquent to be seized and held until the creditors receive satisfaction. The same power was given to the county committees in cases of 20 pounds or under. The committees of safety were further authorized to call all persons liable for public money to account and compel payment by imprisonment and seizure of estates. The power of both provincial council and committees of safety was to last during the recess of Congress and until further order was taken in the matter by that body. The proceedings were to be laid before it for inspection. Finally came the town and county committees. In each county, the freeholders were to elect yearly a committee of 21 as a county committee. In the three largest towns in the province, Edmonton, New Bern, and Wilmington, town committees of 15 were to be chosen. In the smaller towns, which had the right of representation in the provincial Congress, committees of 7 were to be chosen. Permission was given these town and county committees to act together if they saw fit. The committees were to execute within their precincts all orders and resolutions of the Continental and Provincial Congresses and of their district committees of safety. Each town and county committee might make such regulations for its own section as it saw fit. say that no corporal punishment, except imprisonment, might be inflicted. It was thus hoped that the tarring and feathering that had disgraced the colony might be made a thing of the past. Too bad, I love tar and feathers. No person was to be allowed to commence any lawsuit without leave from the county committee, and no suit then pending could be continued without its consent. From each town and county committee, a subcommittee of 7 persons was to be chosen by the members to act as a committee of secrecy, intelligence, and observation, which was to correspond with the provincial council, the committees of safety, and the other committees in North Carolina and neighboring colonies. They were to take up all suspected persons and, if necessary, send them to the provincial council or committee of safety. This schedule, complete anti-well, organized as it seems, was in reality but a compromise and a halfway measure. The importance of the local committees, which had possession of the field, made the convention feel, whether rightly or not, that it was impossible to put at once a controlling central executive over the province. Council meeting but once in 3 months could not endanger the independence of the local committees. Moreover, its duties, as far as specifically outlined, related chiefly to the Army. The function of the district committee was similar, save that the duty of arresting and punishing delinquents was added. It was the town and council, county committees that were especially delegated to carry out the laws of the colony, to control the courts, ding, ding, to govern and police the districts. The system differed from that adopted by other colonies, where the provincial council of safety, besides caring for and directing the army, was entrusted with the execution of the acts of the legislature, and the county committees were used as agents by the central council to carry the plans of the government into effect into the localities. The provincial council met for the first time October 17, 1775, a little more than a month after the adjournment of the Congress. It was in session but 5 days. It next came together in December and was content with a sitting of a week. Its third and last session began on February 28, 1776, and ended March 5th. Meeting at such considerable intervals and so soon dispersing, it was unable not only to become the leading power in the province, but it could not give that close personal attention to the multifarious details of the military establishment which characterized many of the other provincial councils. Many of its duties fell to necessity to the army officers and to the other committees, to the loss of a consistent and economic regulation of the whole. When neither Congress nor council was in session, there was no central government, and the province presented a condition of decentralization that boded ill if a strong attack could be made by the British. The council employed its short sessions in making some provisions for the troops.
Give me a minute.
All the flour and pork for sale in the province was engaged by, and the export of pork, bacon, rice, and peas forbidden, unless salt, arms, and ammunition were brought in return. Commissioners were appointed at the different ports to give permits for this limited trade. Certain of the council chartered vessels and undertook the importation of ammunition, while 3 armed ships were fitted out to protect the trade. Friends of the cause were asked to buy all the powder, saltpeter, and sulfur possible for public use and place it in the hands of the town and county committees. A large committee was appointed to purchase materials and engage workmen to make and mend guns. The gun carriages were repaired and the guns mounted. The council also appointed commissaries and paymasters for the troops and supplied them with money. Although the general orders were issued by the council to the 2 Continental Battalions to oppose the landing of any hostile force, the board was not called upon during the time it was in session to deal with any attack. The attempt was made to isolate Governor Martin completely, that he might not stir up opposition to the government among the Loyalists. The committees of Wilmington and Brunswick and the officers of the troops at Cape Fear were recommended to cut off personal communication from the shore to the Crugier and to examine all letters to the governor. The Wilmington District Committee was authorized to stop the supply of provisions to the ship whenever it was found expedient. In a few cases, the council tried and punished Tories, but they were left generally to the discretion of the local committees. The council recommended that all suspects should be disarmed and required to take oath to oppose neither the Continental nor Provincial Congress, nor to aid the British in any way. Little attempt was made to direct or regulate the local committees. The district committees of safety were not active bodies. The province was not large enough, nor its affairs complex enough, to call for this additional machinery which the Congress had placed between the council and county committees. They had no basis in necessity and answered no purpose which might not have been as well fulfilled by the central council in giving directions and the county committees in cooperating to fulfill them. As six unrelated bodies, the committees of safety could not take the direction of the province while the council was not in session. The town and county committees took charge of their localities with no need of outside assistance. The fact that the council found it necessary to order some of these district committees to meet is a sign they found no business ready at hand that demanded their attention. The town and county committees, on the other hand, were active and energetic. The Wellington Committee collected all the guns in town, bought all the lead that the place afforded to run into balls, employed a powder maker, furnished him with saltpeter and sulfur, and set another workman at the task of making cartridges. It saw that the inhabitants drilled in the militia. It protected the channel by sinking boats and prohibiting supplies from reaching the Crusader before the provincial council took order in the matter. Orders were given for no ship to load or to clear from the port without its permission and that of a higher power. When danger threatened, its district committee was asked for troops. It was dangerous to question its acts for reflections on this on its proceedings or disobedience to its orders were punished with imprisonment, and release was granted only on bonds given for good behavior. Strict account was kept of those who refused to sign the test. If consent was necessary to the prosecution of a lawsuit, and a man who had been imprisoned by a creditor without the committee's permission was set free. In the other counties and towns, work of a similar character went on, each putting its precincts into a position of defense, regulating the business of the courts and the affairs of the people. When danger threatened from the Scottish Highlanders of the back districts, who, at the command of Governor Martin, had gathered to the King's Standard and started on February 17, 1776, on their march to the coast, the provincial council was not in session. Neither did it see fit to summon its members to meet the crisis, but left it to the local committees. The district committees gave orders to their militia officers to march the county to march. The county committees cooperated, and at the Battle of Moore's Creek, February 27, 1776, the force of the Highlanders was completely broken. The provincial council met the next day and participated in the affair only so far as to offer to the troops a vote of thanks. The Fourth Provincial Congress, which met at the call of the council in April 1776, struggled to form a new constitution. But the conservatives and radicals differed so strongly over the provisions of the instrument that the matter was postponed until fall. The Congress contented itself with remedying the faults in the system already in existence. The district committees of safety were dropped. In place of the provincial council, a council of safety was created of the same size and chosen in the same way as its predecessor. It was, however, to be a more permanent body to sit from day to day on the adjournment of the present Congress to the meeting of the next. The members were allowed 20 shillings proclamation money for their services. It was vested with full authority to do all acts necessary for the defense and protection of the province. But this jurisdiction was carefully limited to exclude it from altering, suspending, or abrogating any resolution of the legislature, from emitting bills of credit, from levying taxes, or from laying duties on exports and imports, from giving orders on the Continental Treasury, except on urgent necessity, and then for no sums over £30,000, from erecting any offices or courts, from judging any civil or criminal offense, except where a resolution of the Congress gave it special permission. It could, however, examine anti-commit persons suspected of enmity, to the cause and restrain any from leaving the province by sea. Full power was given to the council to establish courts of admiralty in Edmonton, New Bern, Bath, and Wellington, and to appoint their judges. It was also to appoint commissioners at different ports to see that the continental and provincial restrictions on commerce were carried out. It was further enabled to compel all collectors of public money to account for the same and to see that the proper amount was paid to the treasurer. The council was elected on May 11 of 76, and it was directed that its vote should be taken by districts. Anyone considering himself aggrieved by an order or determination of the council bad leave to appeal against it to the next Congress. While the council served as final judge in complaints brought against the town and county committees. The Committee of Safety, while not sitting without interruption, was in session the greater part of the time from June 6th to October 25th. It had no fixed abode, but sat at intervals in different parts of the province. The arrangement was advantageous in bringing the central government into view of the people, but must have hampered it in receiving information from outside the section in which it was, since no one knew exactly where it was to be found. The council's work resembled that of its predecessor, but was much more affected. It acted as chief executive of the province. It created permanence, made it to the true head of the state in the recess of the legislature, and enabled its supervision to extend to matters of more detail. It also gave the localities greater oversight. It labored steadily to provide arms, ammunition, and salt for troops. Some supplies came in through trade. Some were furnished by the Continental Congress on the Council's application, but North Carolina relied largely upon manufacturing for itself what she needed. It was a great undertaking for a poor colony entering upon a struggle with a rich and powerful nation to establish and encourage manufactories of arms, powder, salt, and saltpeter. The policy, however, was adopted by the Provincial Congress and faithfully carried on by the Council, which furnished the undertakers with money to start the businesses, encouraged them with bounties, and sent even to the northern states for workmen. The promotion of these industries bore heavily upon the people. We find the council enumerating it among the causes which had involved the province in a load of debt well nigh insupportable. This goes on for a little longer, but not much, but that pretty much covers what I wanted to say about the vast differences between Massachusetts, Virginia, and North Carolina, and the manner in which the committees played. And through one, there is a commonality through all of these, and that gets down to the county level. And the county committees of safety were the final arbiters and had a lot of power. And so with that, I want to end because we're out of time. And as Nikki had mentioned, you guys have you have this document to read. If you do have questions, we can pick up next week and write down your questions, and I'll address them then. And with that, I yield.
Well, thank you. That was very interesting, very educational, and it shows, just how much power the committees of safety had, especially back then. It also shows that there are still a need for them today. We just have to change some of the ways of doing things. However, they are of utmost importance that we get them.
That's the beauty that's the beauty of pointing out Massachusetts, Virginia, and North Carolina. They all did things very, very differently. So that shows, as you just mentioned, the flexibility we have in how we can set up our committees of safety to address our own county's needs.
Yes, absolutely. And that's what needs to be done, and that's why one size does not fit all.
But for those who are interested in, explaining to people, what's a committee of safety? Well, there you go. There you go.
Absolutely. Very good, John. I'd like to add something though to it because further down on that comment section where John was reading from, there's a there is a comment, systemic tips for changing a populated system. And I noticed that in what John was reading, that Massachusetts didn't have too many problems. I mean, they were kind of straightforward. They did mention the Tories, and the Tories, of course, were the political bands of that day. Excuse me. And so were the Whigs. And the Whigs and the Tories were mentioned throughout Virginia, Massachusetts, and North Carolina. They had some say-so, and of course, the first paragraph of the Declaration of Independence, when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to, number one, dissolve the political bands that connected them to another. I'm bringing your attention to the systemic tips for changing a populated system, because in there I give a different view of the colonial background from a family perspective, families that had already been entrenched in the colonies that were sent over here as delegates prior to the Revolutionary War. They had a foothold in the colonies, and some of them, like the family that I kind of detail in the colonial background on that on the first slide, in the systemic tips for changing a populated system, that particular family, the grandson of the original, you know, person who came over here, Morris family, was in the council of, or not the council, the Committee of Safety during that period of time. And his brother, who was a governor, also was very instrumental and signed, I believe it was, the Constitution. So just to realize that some of these families had a stake in it, and these families are still prevalent today. Also, what I wanted to also point out is that in Virginia, it was mentioning about there were a lot of personality and envy problems going on. So there was a lot of psychosocial problems going on. And in this systemic tips for changing a populated system, one of the presentations is about skills building for mediators and how to ask questions, about maintenance, champerty, and schmooze, and how politicians like to schmooze, and undue influence, conflict resolution, strategies for transition. And in the North Carolina one, there was a lot of alternative dispute kind of issues being discussed in that during that particular point in time. And in this in these presentations, there's one on alternative dispute resolution. So, and you can go directly to the bottom of that post on the website, on the COS comment section there, and you can go to the wall, the freeconferencecall.com wall, where these presentations were done. And you don't have to listen to me talk unless you want to know what I was saying about the particular PowerPoints that are on there. You could take those PowerPoints and modify them for your group. You don't have to use them exactly as I did, but if you have any questions about it, just go and listen to what I had to say about it. Some of them, I added a lot of things that probably are not relevant to all. However, there's information in there that ties in with the Committees of Safety and some of the problems they had back then from a psychosocial dimension. Okay?
I use. All right. Thank you, Nikki.
You're welcome.
All right, I'm gonna stop recording.